Young. How you doing?
Good, Becca.
The Offspring.
How's it going, Becca?
Dave Grohl. How you going, mate?
Good, man.
Pete, it's been a long time coming.
Oh, Becca, hasn't it indeed?
We go inside the dressing room, speak to the biggest names in music.
Keith Richards, the Rolling Stones.
And crack open their esky.
This is exactly how I imagined you, by the way, sitting opposite me with a vodka and orange.
You're a discerning chap.
This is The Rider.
Hey, it's Becca. Welcome back to The Rider. And one reminder, make sure you click follow and subscribe to all the episodes to come of The Rider, no matter what app you use, whether it's Apple or Spotify. And this week, it is a big one. You might have seen Australian story over the last 2 weeks, the story of Silverchair.
Hi, I'm Daniel.
And I'm Chris.
And I'm Dan, and we're Silverchair.
Silverchair was a band of three young guys from Newcastle that, you know, had a dream.
We were brothers in arms on this mission together to conquer the world.
Silverchair.
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 The Rise of Silverchair, it is out now, the book Love and Pain from Chris Jahanyu and Ben Gillies. It is an incredible read, and if you are a Silverchair fan, I'm sure you probably got it already. Some of the stories out of this book, a celebration of this band out of Newcastle, these kids who were just so motivated and so talented, brilliant songwriters, and they were genuine friends. One band Australia has to be proud of.
Like, we were kids. Like, so the fact that we were, like, pulling off those shows and doing what we were doing, like, it even kind of blows my mind now that we were getting away with it. Maybe we were just faking it until we made it. I don't know how we did it, but somehow we did. We were really lucky with the people that we had around us, and, you know, and my parents were always really supportive of what I was doing, so.
There's Ben Gillies on The Rider just last year, and now with the book out, Love and Pain, Chris Jahanyu, Ben Gillies on Zoom. There they are. G'day, fellas. How are you?
How are you, man?
It's finally almost out.
Yes. Plenty of juice for you.
Love and Pain. Tell me about that first of all, the name of the book.
The title really just came about from Sophie, the publisher we've been working with here at Hachette. In a meeting after, I think, like one of the first versions had been pulled together. It was just initially her description, her way of describing what she'd just read, essentially. Mm. Upon sort of getting to that point, what are we going to name it? What are we going to call? What's the title? We sort of were going around in circles on a few other suggestions, and then we just kept coming back to Love and Pain. Like, we were like, it's everything. I don't know. It just seems the best way to, you know, describe or give an insight into what you're about to read.
The thing I love about it is as well, it's bite-sized chapters too. Like it's an easy read, and the stories
are... You can kind of pick it up anywhere, yeah.
When did the conversation start, by the way? So it's been a few years in the making?
Kind of. Like, I guess I spoke to Chris maybe a few years ago about, you know, the idea of doing a book, and I guess Chris's position was, you know, I'd prefer to do something as, you know, a united front with all the entire band. But I guess the real trigger moment was when my twin boys were born. That was the moment I decided I want to put my story into a book. And because Chris, you know, kind of made it clear that he didn't really want to do it, I'd started the process, you know, of working with Hachette. And then I called Chris in a very early stage and said, oh, look, would you like to be involved in any way? And he was like, initially he was like, no, you know, I won't be involved. But then I kind of said to him, hey, look, this is just starting. Like, if you wanted to still be involved with this as a co-author and we rewrite it together, then that's still an option. But, you know, you'd have to make up your mind pretty quick.
And it's a big step,
Chris,
isn't it?
Yes, for years had just parked everything and put it over there in a box and just left it. So, you know, it doing it well essentially would involve really sort of deep diving back into, you know, some really fantastic times and some quite difficult times as well. So it was just sort of being emotionally ready for that as well.
Ben and I caught up for beers really often. We did an interview maybe a few months ago as well, and I never felt comfortable bringing up Silverchair because I don't think you wanted to talk about it. So I think it is good to be at the point where you're ready. You can talk about it. Like we've done interviews where it was on, you know, your solo stuff, and I got a vibe that you don't bring up Silverchair because it's not fair. But this is obviously it's good therapy as well. It's a bit of a celebration of everything you've achieved.
Yeah, totally. That's definitely the right. That's the tone. The analogy we would definitely use.
Yeah,
for sure.
The fact that that's what you've just naturally saying that you've gotten from it. That's kind of what we've been saying during other interviews. That it really is a celebration. You know, even with the more challenging stuff or the tougher moments that we've had to deal with. I think overall, like it's been a positive experience, and I think and the process of writing the book has been a cathartic experience as well. A lot of healing and having a medium to tell our story as well. And again, back to the children, like you know, I think just having something for our kids to read when they're old enough, you know, to be able to read our story from our perspectives in one nice kind of location is good as well, you know, rather than them going and Googling and piecing together a story from clickbaity news articles. Like I think that was a really important thing to give them something where they can read our story.
When I was thinking about it last night, I wonder if it was childbirth that might have given you a bit of a push, because you do want a legacy, something to pass on to the kids, and I'm glad you said that because I was wondering that. When you look back at the fun times and everything, does it make you want to pick up the phone and rekindle friendships with Daniel, or does it sort of bring that to the surface a little bit?
I think the book is more about, you know, it's more about just telling the story and just you know, it's not really about, well, it's not about getting the band back together. You know, I think we really tried hard to be respectful to Daniel, and because, you know, we're all three of us had the experience, but I guess we're telling it from our points of view. But you know, I guess the purpose of the book was, you know, was that kind of was more about us just getting it, you know, getting all those thoughts and feelings out there and on paper. You know, rather than, you know, try to rekindle the band.
It was such a great era. And I think everyone forgets how young you guys were, because you really were young and writing songs that were way beyond that age group, really.
Yeah, it does feel like a whole other lifetime ago, really. And
it is,
yeah. and I guess, you know, forming the band around sort of that 12, 13, and then all touring the world by sort of 14, 15. It's been a hell of a ride. it's been really interesting. Like there's stuff that I'd just completely forgotten, certain funny moments and that through, working through the book. It's been nice.
Yeah, that was it. Rock and Rio, where you were, you know, leaving with police escort and wondering how the hell you're going to get to the airport in time, and that would have been nuts for these teenage kids.
Yeah, and that whole experience of Rock and Rio. I mean, we hadn't played a gig for quite a while leading up to it, so we just spent some bulk time at home and got the call up. Essentially, did a few days rehearsal and then flew out for Rio, and not. You know, everyone, like we'd sort of been informed, this Rock and Rio, it's huge, but not until you see 250,000 people standing in front of you, do you understand or comprehend just like, holy crap, this is just wild, And to have all, like the year we played, I mean, there was everyone from Guns N' Roses to
NSYNC, Britney Spears,
Chili Peppers to, I think Neil Young did, no, there was...
Oh. Papa Roach.
Yeah, it was just like,
I don't know, it was a weird, like,
everyone who was anyone was there performing at this Rock and Rio. Yeah.
What was that green room like, or green rooms? That for kids, you must be wandering around going, oh my God, you know.
Yeah, the scale of it was just so big. So you sort of, because there were all the dressing rooms were, was quite a distance from where the actual stage was. So I don't know, like it seemed like an hour or two before we even went on, we got shuffled to like a green room at the back of the stage. And yeah, it was
a bit of a weird setup. All the artists stayed at the Sheraton in Rock and Rio. So I think this is in the book if you're not already up to it, but there is a moment when Britney Spears decides to go for a swim, and her bodyguard literally just walks in behind her fully clothed into the pool. So there was, you know, the Sheraton was definitely an interesting place. Actually, even another time we're in Brazil, I remember seeing one of the guys from the Ramones. Mm. Do you remember that? It was blistering hot. It was crazy hot.
That was like one of our first trips to South America, I think. Yeah, it was like Sex Pistols.
Was it Ramones?
Cypress Hill.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. Sex Pistols, Cypress Hill and Ramones.
And it all always happened at this one hotel. But I remember seeing one of the guys from the Ramones walk out. It was so fucking hot. And he still had like tight black jeans on, black boots, a big black leather jacket. And it's just like, that guy must be
melting,
cooking. He's actually cooking.
So that's an incredible experience. I mean, the people you would have met, I mean, you talked about your first arias. I'll say scary, but also just an incredible experience. You had Janet Jackson there, but the people who you idolized growing up as kids, like UMI, me meeting Tim Rogers is a spin out because he's legendary, but for you, because it was one of your favorite bands.
Years later, Tim Conley played at my wedding too. And
cool.
Yeah, been totally spoiled.
Rock and Rio was one thing, but I remember growing up, everyone talking about you guys playing the Royal Easter Show, and I think it might have been 1996. And was that one of your most wild local gigs you've ever done? Because I remember hearing it was pretty hectic.
That would have been the last Frog Stomp show, was it?
Yeah.
The Easter show, yeah.
I've got memories of that. I think it may have been just before they kind of commandeered that area and made it into Fox Studio.
Yeah, to be built. Yeah.
And like there was some crazy lineups to get into the kind of arena where we were playing. And it was just a bit of a kind of frenzy. But I also remember being on stage. I don't know if you remember this. We were playing on stage and no one warned us that the fireworks were going to go off during our performance.
Great.
So I remember being on stage and playing, and then you start seeing like the glow of light and the bang, bang, bang of the fireworks, and like no one warned us. So we were just kind of, you know, it was all part of our pyrotechnic show.
What experience for your kids. And look, I'm glad you went with Murmur because I'm reading about, you know, the two Johns and John O'Donnell. From all my experiences meeting him and hanging out with him, he's one of the loveliest people you'll ever meet in the music industry. Like just such a genuine, nice person. And there aren't many of them, by the way. There's a lot of pricks in the music industry, but he made the right choice.
I think before we even got to the point of having John Watson as management, the two Johns were sort of in Sony. And any engagement we had with them just felt, you just knew they were good people. So it was a no-brainer going down that path with Murmur, and then subsequently asking John Watson to be the band's manager after that.
Yeah.
I think we've just been really fortunate with the people that we've managed to have around the band. We've been very lucky.
And a lot of it was I've found was like same with the title, right? It's a lot of it is instinctual, you know, like you generally get a feeling if someone has good intent, and you know, it was really obvious from even for young boys that, you know, John Watto and John O'Donnell, like, you know, they just had the right intention for the band. You know, they didn't. They weren't looking to exploit like the teenage sensation kind of angle. They always had a long career in mind for us from the get-go. So, you know, and I think we just, you know, we probably wouldn't have articulated it quite like that when we were 14, but we were just working off a feeling, and it just felt right with those guys.
And that's the thing, they were looking way long-term, because they could have done the short, what do they call it, the short sweetener and gone for the smash hits, you know, teen sensation stuff, and it would have been great, but you wouldn't be pigeonholed for, you know, all that maybe 1 year later, and that would have been it. So,
yeah.
You know, I look back and think of the rise, and also this second album was you know, really just as good as Frog Stomp. I mean, it's not often that the Difficult second album ends up being just as big. I mean, Freak Show was such a big return when that came out.
It's all recorded here.
We did the first three records at the same studio at the festival in Piedmont. I don't know how or why that happened. Maybe just because it was obviously that we felt comfortable there, and also they had the desk they had there and the equipment just sounded incredible. But I don't know, maybe we were kind of sheltered from a lot of that pressure to have to deliver a second record. Like, we were still young enough to be able to be naive enough and protected enough, maybe, that we weren't kind of feeling that pressure, you know, that we were still far enough removed that that we were just kind of focusing on the music and just making songs that we thought were cool, you know, similar to Frog Stomp. But, you know, there was definitely, once the band became successful, I think, you know, you can't help but have some of that pressure creep in, even if it's only subtle.
I remember one story, go back to Frog Stomp quickly. I remember John O'Donnell saying that obviously you got the different version. You got the single version of Tomorrow, and then you got the album version, which sounds slightly different. I remember John was saying that he was in there when you were recording the album version, and it was maybe a second or two quicker, and they found it really difficult to hold you guys back because you were just, you know, obviously a different environment.
And
he kept saying, do it again. And I might have even thought about bringing in a click track or something to hold you back or something. But do you remember that?
I think it was the opposite way around. By the time we got to the record, we'd done some touring. We got more confident as musicians and as players. So I think we were just playing a lot more steady. So on that first version, if you go and have a listen to them, you'll notice that, like, the verse, just the pace of it drops right down, and then it comes to the chorus and the tempo just lifts right up, where on the album version it was just a lot more kind of even throughout. So what that actually did was it made it longer. So I think what Watto had to kind of work with the producer and work some magic in order to actually like speed up some parts, particularly in the choruses, so I had that same feeling of really like lifting into the chorus.
Because that's right, coming out of the verses, it felt like this energy, but the choruses on the album version were essentially the similar tempo, but like Ben saying, it just didn't have that same effect that he was probably feeling listening to the other version.
Now I want you to go back to the Newcastle Knights winning their premiership. This would have been the 97 one. Did Joey Johns break into Daniel's house, like the family home, and take him out on Mad Monday? Do you remember that?
He did go and knock on his door and get him out of bed, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I wasn't there. I don't know the full story. I think breaking in is probably an elaboration. Is that a word?
Fabrication. Exaggeration.
I don't think that's what happened. I imagine he just
knocked on the door and went inside and dragged him out of bed. The whole town was going absolutely bonkers.
So yeah, look, I think that was just,
we all went down, and you were with us. Went down and we're bloody hanging out of trees and waiting for the bus to pull up outside the workers' club there. I think they rolled in like after midnight sometime, didn't they?
We didn't put this in the book. We probably should have mentioned. We should have mentioned the Newcastle Knights winning the premiership. Might have to do a reprint.
Yeah, you can put it in the second version these days. So Ben, you've had you know, music out, and for the first time you actually put it under your name. We talked about that in a previous interview. You know, because it was Bento, but then finally you were like, you know what, I'm ready to put it out as Ben Gillies. And Chris, how do I put it? You got a million bars and pubs in Newcastle. You're a baron.
Yeah, I did. I now only got one. Just made a few changes in life and dialed things back a little post, just some health journeys. I did dive pretty heavily into the whole hospitality world and, really loved it.
So the one to go to is the Edwards, is that right?
Yeah, the Edwards. I don't own that one anymore.
Oh, okay, that's not the one. So is it the Criterion now?
Sold that as well.
You're still on the website.
We're all still going in great venues. Flotilla is all I've got at the moment. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll have to go to the Flotilla and check it out. But you also got to get your face taken off the Criterion website because you're still there.
Am I still on it?
You're still on it. So, what was your first big day out like? And I'm running off my memory. It might have been 96 from memory, or 95. But I remember that was a controversial one because Courtney Love was also on the bill and she was trying to start something. You might have even been unaware of it. It might have been something that was bubbling away in the media and you might have been protected by it. But I think Courtney was sort of seeing Silverchair as like they were trying to steal Kurt's image almost, and she was making references to it on stage.
Yeah, I think she's possibly just playing up to that a little bit. I don't know. I do recall a little bit of that going on at the time. Yeah, 95, 96, it was a while ago.
I think it might have been 95.
Yeah. The old skate stage, it was pretty wild. Especially I think it was the Melbourne one in particular, and they were just like stage diving off the roof of this little shed this building that was sort of just to the right of the stage. Yeah, it was just chaos.
It's almost like a rite of passage playing on a big day out, but we've got to keep in mind that this was only a year and a bit after getting a big break and maybe a year and a half or 2 years after not winning the talent contest in Newcastle. So it was a huge rise.
Yeah, look, it all definitely happened very quickly. But I don't know. I guess from our perspective, it didn't feel unnatural. It didn't feel scary. Like, I guess we were pretty prolific in terms of where we could play. Like, we'd play anywhere and everywhere we could. Like, we played in band comps, talent comps. Like, we'd done a lot of performing. So, and, you know, we'd had a reasonable amount of experience in studios as well. So, you know, although we were young, I definitely felt like, and we were quite ambitious too. Like, we were really going for it. We really wanted to get ourselves out there. So, although it did take off really quickly, like it didn't feel like we were underprepared or we weren't ready for it. I think that goes, that the proof is in the pudding, right? Like we were able to get on that stage and kind of deliver. So, because we were fucking awesome.
Kids are brutal though. Like you went back to high school and they very quickly dragged you back down to earth, didn't they? Because that's what kids do. They're assholes.
Our friend circle and through high school definitely kept us pretty grounded. And as Ben said before, they knew us before the band. So they already had their baseline. Having the spotlight on you, then there was a bit of the old tall poppy going on as well, so you're sort of navigating people's sort of negative opinions or mudslinging for no reason other than them just getting a kick out of it. But our friend circle was, yeah, it was, I think that played an important role through those early years.
Before we go, I want to talk about one of the early stories in the book, and I love this, the way you've described it. You're sitting down in front of AC/DC's manager and he wants to sign you up. And this is before you went with John Watson. And you must have been thinking, wow, this is AC/DC's manager. But you were just kids, and he took you to just the wrong restaurant to woo three kids from Newcastle, and it didn't work.
I guess he just didn't recognize. Well, he didn't recognize that he was trying to woo three teenage boys, but maybe he was taking the angle that actually he needed to kind of impress Watto and our parents who were there, who were kind of the gatekeepers. But ultimately, if the three of us turned around and said, "Oh, no, we don't like him," like, I don't think we would have. We never would have signed with him, you know. So I do think he just missed the mark, you know. I think if he just took us out for a hamburger and some chips at a diner, like, he would have won more brownie points. But yeah, it was it didn't work. I mean, we were just desperate to get to Piccadilly Circus.
Yeah, and we just wanted to go play video games.
Well, it's a bloody great story. It's a great read, and I'm really glad that you guys got together and did this, because you know, I think it's great to set the record straight and hear how this you know, band started in Newcastle and the rise from there, and the pain as well, which is also in the book. So Love and Pain is the book. Chris and Ben, it's great to spend some time with you guys. It's good to see you looking so well and happy.
Thank you.
Thanks, man.
Just a couple of good blokes having a yarn. There they are, Ben and Chris from Silverchair. Love and Pain is out now, and also the audio book. You can get that online. Next week on The Writer with Becco. Well, it's been 25 years since the debut album of The Living End. 25 years. There's a very important gig coming up in Melbourne for that. And a re-release of the album as well next week. Chris and Scott from The Living End join The Writer. We'll catch you then. This is The Writer with Becco.